project. Sometimes you find out several years later why you really did a film and you didn't realize at the time what the great attraction was. Because it's always a mystery of why something turns you on to an extent that you say, I want to spend 2 years of my life on it. Because I read a lot of things. And sometimes I could admire a book a great deal. And sometimes I can even think of this will make a wonderful film. And I'd love to see the film, but I don't want to spend 2 years of my life making this film. And then you read something else, and you think, oh boy, this is tough to do, and how do you translate this into film? And you can't get it out of your mind, and you think, somewhere I've got to do this film. I will start with the basics of the story, and I think I am fascinated by almost all stories like this, and all melodramas and suspense pictures deal with good and evil. And in most cases, there's the good guy and there's the bad guy. In this case, it's very hard to know who the good guys are and the bad guys are. And it's not so simple. Here you have a good man, this hero, responsible man, a man who hates criminality, totally controlled man, has totally control over his life and his emotions. And he becomes involved with a woman who obsesses him sexually and loses total control of himself and finds himself on this total destructive path. So it's dealing and to the point where when she's murdered, he could well be the murderer and finds himself being prosecuted for that murder. There's something in that basic story of what happens to that man and who that man is that seems to appeal to something very primitive and basic in me. I am fascinated by the ambivalences and the antitheses that exist within one person. And to see the good man, the controlled man, the civilized man, suddenly overtaken by the uncivilized impulses that are within us all, by the uncontrolled emotional impulses, the irrational impulses. Nothing. I'm endlessly interested in very rational people who suddenly are overtaken by irrational impulses. There's something basic in that that is endlessly interesting to me. I suppose that life, in many ways, is an unconscious battle in all of us to keep being the responsible people we're supposed to be.
So is it a measure for you of how well the film succeeds in terms of how much we are prepared to accept his possible guilt?
Well,
as we watch, if we are...
Well, it's you can or cannot believe it. When we took it out to preview with big audiences in a theater for the first time, my question was, could they believe that Harrison Ford might be guilty of murder, since he's a guy they like? One of the reasons they cast him is they like him so much. They want to have somebody they could relate to. And what I found out with the general audience, twice at that time, period, was that indeed they strongly believed in the possibility and still liked him anyway, which interested me. And even those who were convinced he did it. And I think the reason that they wanted him to be freed at the trial and not to be convicted. And I think that is partially because of the nature of the character, that this is a man who seems to be a decent man. If he committed a murder, did it in an uncontrolled moment, and who has an enormous sense of guilt about it. And I think that a sense of guilt seems to allow audiences to forgive an awful lot. There doesn't seem to be a callous bone in the man's body. But what interests me is that you can say to people, this man may well be a murderer, and they can accept that and still be sympathetic to it. There'll be other people who say, well, I don't think he ever committed the murder. I mean, that becomes a personal thing of relating or not relating on some level. Do I think that that's a man Do I think, as I see the film, that he could be capable of that murder? Oh, yes. And, I think a man who has such control of himself, who feels he's a responsible person, who feels so out of control, so degraded and humiliated, could be capable of a great many things.
You bring up
and that I tried to maintain in the film, is that characters have edges and surprises in them you don't expect. That's what Scott wrote. So that I didn't want her to be just a bitch. She is an ambitious woman who uses everything she can to get ahead. If she was a man, nobody would think twice about
it.
Right.
You can't tell me that if men existed in a world where it was much harder for them to get ahead than women, and women had all the power, and they were great sex objects to these women in power, that they wouldn't happily use their sexuality. I happen to work in a line of in a profession where that is done. I mean, there are men who have, I'm sure there are probably plenty of men who slept their way to the top. I don't know, plenty. I mean, I never had the opportunity. You know, I mean, there were women in powerful positions. There are actresses, stars who can make a man a success. Or, depending on your sexual orientation, there can be, after all, I mean, in the arts, it can be a man attracted to another man, whatever it is. But I think when men get very smug about sexually opportunistic women, I say, oh, you know, come off it, guy, you know? I mean, if you had the chance with all your ambition, you wouldn't eat different. And I'm not saying this is an evil woman. I mean, I went out of my way to show that she was a good prosecutor, as Scott did, and that she related to that boy, that little child, had compassion for that child, and went out of her way to fight for that child, to protect that child. There's nothing in saying that if she'd gotten away or out of a prosecutor, she might not have been one of the best prosecutors in the history of that town. But yes, she is a woman who uses what she has. But I don't think that opportunism and ambition is in any way restricted to one sex or the other. Nor did I feel, do I feel, the fact that she rejected him, you know, sexually, a grown man, he wasn't a 10-year-old boy, makes her a bad, and because she hurt him, makes him a bad boy. Nor is she responsible for his fidelity. He is, not she. So I wasn't trying to say, look at this evil woman. Yes, I think I as an audience start relating to Harrison, the man, because he, you know, I tell the story through him, it's his story, and I get some of the feelings toward her that he gets. But that doesn't mean that I, as a storyteller, as a director, am trying to make that condemnation. Now, I love working with Harrison. He's a very specific man. He's very straight, in that you know where you're at with him at all times. I don't feel he has a hidden agenda. He doesn't play games. There are certain people who live on playing games and ego games, and there were certain, you know, there were certain very gifted people who just have a need for Byzantine complexity in their relationship. And I find that exhausting, and there's none of that with Harrison. I mean, I thought of Harrison when I first started working on the film, primarily because he just reminded me of, I wanted this all-American male that people could relate to, who would look like a decent, responsible man that audiences like and care about. American hero, but somebody also could be the average and everyman character. It could just be living in the Midwest, and certainly he has that. Whether he could play, and there's also some kind of mystery I always feel in Harrison. There's always something underneath. I'm not talking in Star Wars, but you know, things like when you're playing a cartoon role. But there's something in him that really wonderful, fascinating stories have to me, that there's a mystery somewhere that you don't, that there's more there than is being revealed. And there's, for all of his humor and his openness, there's something of a man who keeps his own counsel. And I met with Harrison. I said, look, I think you'd be wonderful for this. I don't know, I've never seen you play this and this and this and this, and you'd have to tell me and if you're interested. And I flew the ranch, and we spent a day together in Jackson Hole. He hadn't read the script yet. He'd read the book just to meet each other. No, he hadn't even read the book yet at that point, just to meet each other. and see if we really wanted to work together, if we really felt that after 6 hours he couldn't wait for me to get on the plane, I couldn't wait to get on the plane. And so it was desperately talking about life, liberty, and the pursuit of survival. And I sent him a script and then flew back to Jackson Hole, and we spent several days together and read the script from beginning to end. I played all the other parts badly, and we sat around a kitchen table, and he read through Rusty Savage's lines and the scenes. He stopped and we talked and we made notes on the script, things bothered him about the script. The script was still very much in work. And then had I decided, did he want to play that part? The more time I spent with him, the more convinced I was that he could do it and that I really wanted him desperately. Well, I try to play it very cool, because there's nothing worse than putting too much pressure on an actor, because I feel very strongly, no matter how much I want an actor, if something that actor doesn't want to play that part, don't talk him into it. Don't try to talk him into it, because there's something inside of him that's going to stop giving the performance. They're just going to fight it all the way, and no matter how good potentially that character can be in that, that actor can be in that. And so I waited a while, and then he finally called me and said, yeah, you know, it's scary, and it's difficult, and it's a complicated role, and he's a man who doesn't talk much about himself, and he's a repressed man, and it's going to require a lot of control, and it's not going to be easy, but yeah, let's jump in. So we did. From that point on, the script was still in work. He was very much a part of helping with the storytelling. He asks deceivingly simple questions that require complicated answers. He'd be a very good director. I said if he wants me to produce a film for him, I would. And I worked with two actors and one writer who become wonderful directors. Jim Brooks, starting over, become a great director. Warren Beatty was in The Parallax View. I think he's done a few things since. And Bob Redford in All the President's Men. And then went on to direct Ordinary People. And Harrison has it if he wants to use it. He has a great sense of craft. Gordon Willis, the cinematographer, was really loved working with him because he said, God, he understands the technical problems. He understands that beyond his problems as an actor and your problems as a storyteller and working, making the scene work and all that, that there are problems in photography, and it makes my work so much easier. Harrison is, we most people know by now, is a superb carpenter and supported himself for years as a carpenter. Made a living as an actor, and he's a craftsman in that way. What Harrison builds is very precise, and in the telling of a story and going over that, he's very precise in the questions he asks and how he wants it told and the way he goes about acting. But what delighted me was that while he would plan and work, I never knew what he was going to do next. He was not one of those actors who plans it all so carefully that he protects himself, and it's all rather effective, but if you do six takes, you're going to get six of the exact same thing. If you did six takes, you'd have got six different performances, depending on how he was feeling, and he let himself go with that, and I felt, while he's playing a character who cannot expose himself, obviously, he wasn't faking, he just wasn't using technique in those scenes. He was letting it happen. I mean, when Brian Dennehy said to him, and it wasn't in the original script, "You're a good man, Rusty." His face just sort of collapsed, and all the guilt in that character came out, and I didn't know he was going to do that. And he almost started to break and had to pull himself together. There were a couple of times where there was one time he broke down, and I cut it out of the film because I said, you know, it's wonderful in the scene, but it's going to hurt the ending. And that was, but it just happened. When in an unlikely place, I love when things happen in unlikely places, when he goes in to tell he's been accused and he's going to be tried for murder, and he says it's going to break us, you know, to get a good lawyer, it's going to break us, and she says, we'll mortgage the house. And when she said, we'll mortgage the house, in one take, he just broke. It was a responsible man who prides himself on taking care, I know it was going on in him, and taking care of his family, realizing that his behavior is destroying that family, is bankrupting that family as well. And I left a tiny bit in, actually, just a soup songs in. But what happened was that happened on a tape because that's what happened to him. He doesn't protect himself in that way. I mean, when he's accused in Brian Dennehy's office, his voice changed. You know, his voice got very hoarse. I don't know if you noticed. If you've ever seen any part of the picture again, his voice just started to go hoarse and he could hardly speak. And you can't fake that. It's a physical thing. Just the vocal cords started to just tighten up on him. And he doesn't do any of that in a show-off way. But it's there. And I found it very exciting to work with. We had a 3-week rehearsal period, and I think he was concerned that might be a lot, and I said, listen, if it starts to get to be too much, I'll stop it. As it turned out, I think it was invaluable for us, and I think he might have been concerned that if I would start locking performances in early and take away spontaneity, and I don't do that in rehearsal. It's a very loose time for me, and it's going over and having the character, giving the actors a chance to know each other and know me, and for us to hopefully come out of it trusting each other more so we can make asses of ourselves when the real work comes down the pike. And also, you know, to do all the intellectual work of testing the character, testing the script, and does this work, and do we have to change this? So that when you get onto the set, you can just start letting the emotions take over.
I'm probably forgetting something along the way, but is this the biggest courtroom situation you've dealt with since Mockingbird?
Yeah, and I produced Mockingbird. Bob Mulligan, never forget, Bob Mulligan directed Mockingbird, and I produced it.
As far as your control with that picture and then your direction here, talk to me a little bit maybe about courtroom scenes. Go as little or as long as you want to about it. What place does it play in a dramatic film?
Well, you know, the
could it be your downfall as well
as
the
dramatic? Yeah, sure,
it could
be a downfall. First of all, you've got all those people sitting in one place and not much movement, you know? And as poor Paul Winfield says, I got this big part, this big colorful part, and I'm locked in. All you see is my head. I said, it's like a Punch and Judy show, and they just sort of, you'll be held up there, and all we see is this black robe and you and your face, and that's all you got. That's right. That's what you're locked in there. You know, you can't keep wandering around. It just ain't fitting. It's not going to work. And it's true. People are locked in that way. But if you open a picture in a courtroom scene, you don't know the people involved. It's not going to seem very interesting. You're curious, perhaps. If it's murder and it's a life at stake, that makes you curious. But if you spend half the film involving the audience, hopefully, in this man's fate and his possible guilt or innocence, then you've built up suspense to what will happen in that trial to these people I care about. That's what can make a courtroom scene fascinating. Is he guilty? Is he innocent? There is a battle of wills and wits in a courtroom that's fascinating to people. There is a big winner and a big loser in a courtroom sequence that's fascinating to people. And secrets are exposed that is fascinating to people. So you have a lot of things going for you in that way. I don't like to juice things up. Which means, you know, what I don't like is you say, okay, we've got people sitting there, so you do a 360-degree camera turn around somebody's head, and now they're revealing these things, and suddenly you can counting the hairs in the back of their neck as you wait them to get to see if the right ear is exactly like the left ear, and if his right profile is better than his left profile, and which is the best side of his face, so you get back to your full shot again. If the scene is not playing, just trying to amuse them, trying to distract them, when the essence of a courtroom should be everybody's so focused because they're fighting for their lives. It's a battle scene. It is a field of battle, a courtroom to me.
Also, for one more question.
Could you?
And so I try to do it just holding on faces. And, you know, matter of fact, I said to Gordon, it's like, it should be like a Rembrandt, this thing. It's like, you know, faces coming out of darkness and just popping out at you. And so much of a courtroom scene's reaction, seeing the, you know, you understand what is important by seeing the reactions. Suddenly you cut to this prosecutor and say, wait a minute, that prosecutor was reacting. That must be important to them. Or you cut to Rusty Savage, who was a prosecutor, who was paralyzed. In a way, it's very dramatic. When Harrison said, do you realize that as an actor, I have a leading role, and I get to the courtroom scene, and I can't open my mouth, and I sit there watching. I said, yes, and I said, and it could be, and it very frustrating. And I said, and if you do it right, it's going to be very specific, and the audience is going to relate to you. And yes, I mean, you're trapped with him. I sometimes like to show the camera showing somebody trapped and locked in place. In all the President's Medal, I'll never forget when I did this first long telephone sequence with Bob Redford, and he was on the phone. I didn't show the person the other side of the phone. I showed him making 3 or 4 phone calls in a row trying to pursue this lead. And I wanted, and he, after the first phone call, he hung up and he started walking off the set. I said, "Where are you going?" He said, "Well, while you change your camera angle for the next phone call, I'm going to go off." I said, "There's no change of camera angle." And that phone call, the one after the one, he said, "But they fall following each other. You're not cutting to anybody on the other side of the phone." I said, "I want that audience to know what it's like to be a journalist locked in that same place trying to make a faceless person, whom you only get as the voice, talk and say things, reveal things he doesn't want to reveal." That is the nature and the truth of the scene. If that's not dramatic, yeah, all the change of angles is not gonna help you. So, and for me also in this film, there was a style that required that. What was fascinating about the style of that book is he told these lurid events, about these lurid events, Scott Turow, in this lawyerly prose, this rational prose written in the first person, discussing these shocking and passionate and hot events. And, I said to Gordon, I said, "Listen, I got to warn you, Gordon, I don't see the camera moving around a lot. It's going to be very controlled. If we're going to get the style, it should be kind of a dispassionate style for these hot events." I mean, you have this lovemaking scene. You can't say it's a love scene; it's a lovemaking scene, in which that character's fall from grace, and the camera just stays like a cold, objective voyeur seeing it. It's kind of icy. I wanted it to be chilling in its own way, and so I feel about something like a courtroom scene, getting back to that. You must go for the truth of where is that excitement at that point. How is it affecting those people?
Just a few words about the challenge of adapting the novel to the screen.
Well, Frank Pearson and I did the screenplay, and a few words. It's probably 5 hours worth of work.
It's okay. We'll take it.
We were blessed in the fact that Scott Turow, unlike a lot of novelists, writes some absolutely wonderful playable dialogue. I mean, for example, just all of the judges' dialogue is straight out of the book, and you see it with a big audience, and it plays like gangbusters. When I was at Yale Drama School 5 billion years ago, we had this one of these rules that novelists, the printed word, printed dialogue, is hard to act. It's unactable. It's not like dramatic dialogue. And that's nonsense. There are certain novelists with great ears and certain novelists with rotten ears. And Scott Turow has a great ear, and those people talk the way people talk. And that was
that
a...
Other that, bunch.
Well, yes.
That other bunch.
Yes. Then, yeah, exactly. And, and Yo Mama.
Well,
things
what
like,
a segue.
But structurally, you
never,
kept...
You never put us in, but...
Do it now.